Mr. Condren Realto.
Well, as I was saying, we didn't think too much of promotion per se in those days, because in the Marines generally you were in, say, 4 years or just under before you were accepted for what they call the junior promotion course. You were then made a sort of acting lance corporal on the course, and when you had successfully completed the course, that was that. But then you might wait another 6 months or a year before actually being made corporal. So in general, you could say that, in general terms, for people in the Marines in the position that I was at that time, say, continuous service people, volunteers in other words, you'd go, say, 4 years, 4 or 5 years perhaps before you made corporal, and then it might be another 7 or 8 years before you made sergeant. And you might, well, most people came out of the Marines with the rank of sergeant or color sergeant. You then, of course, had the option of signing on for another 12, and you could then be promoted. There wasn't, in the Marines, there wasn't any sort of automatic promotion. Any promotion you got, you usually had to work for. Outside, of course, of, say, in wartime, you know, obviously, if there's casualties, then the promotion rate might be speeded up. But in peacetime, you couldn't, even if you worked very hard, you know, if you were an exceptional sort of candidate, even then it wasn't too easy just to get automatic promotion. The time element did come into it, and the service element.
Could I ask you about the attitude in the Marines towards the civilian world? Did the Marines respect the civilian world, or was there a feeling that servicemen like you were getting a raw deal from the civilian world?
No, there was no feeling we were getting a raw deal. After all, we had volunteered. We didn't think about it too much. We had a normal respect, you know, for civilians or anyone else. Although we did always feel that we were a bit better. Not only a bit better than the average civilian, but a bit better than anyone in the other services. As I say, this goes back to this esprit de corps that is, sort of brainwashing, if you like, which is inculcated into you. And there were not, my recollection, many Marines, or fellow Marines in those days, who didn't feel themselves a cut above everyone else in the country or everyone else in the world, if you like.
In what specific respects?
I don't know, maybe you felt you were better trained to cope with things, or if you're put in a tight situation, you have a better chance of getting out of it, because of your own individual training or the training of the people around you. You had the feeling that they wouldn't let you down. Later on, this was certainly the case, for instance, when I went into 41 Commando. Because another thing about the Royal Marines is, we'll say at that time, I mean, most people outside of the national servicemen, but if you talk about the continuous servicemen, you were in for 12 years. Marines is not a numerically large outfit or a regiment. There's, I don't know, 600, 700 people perhaps in all of the Marines. Once you were in the Marines 4 or 5 years, you gradually almost got to know, you know, just about everyone, or at least you could go to any sort of ship or barracks and so on. If you didn't know people, it was unusual you didn't know someone there. And if you didn't know any individual, you certainly knew individuals who knew other friends of yours. You know, it was a kind of, I don't know, a kind of family thing in the Marines. This feeling was very definite. So when, as I say, when I eventually went into the commando, you got this feeling there was people there that I had known for several years, and, you know. And if you have people like that, you know, by your side, say in action or something, then you know you can rely on them, you know you can count on them.
as far as the attitude towards civilians was concerned, was there a feeling that civilians were ill-disciplined or even sluttish or slobbish in their ways?
To some extent, yes, to some extent. But to tell you quite honestly, we didn't really think about it a lot. You know, in those terms, at that time, we didn't really... It wasn't something that was preeminent in our minds. It was just a fact of life. You just got on with it, you know. We didn't think too much about it.
In Rudyard Kipling's poetry, mm-hmm. He makes his servicemen in India in the 19th century have a certain attitude towards civilians, that the civilians in a time of war are all over you, but once they've been saved, once the country's been saved, they forget about you and you're left to rough it. Was there any kind of feeling like that in the Marines?
Rudyard Kipling was a writer, and a very good writer. I know the man quite well. But don't forget that he was writing. He was probably reflecting feelings that were felt by the servicemen in those days. But I should imagine that very few of the servicemen in those days, or even myself when I was a serviceman, could have... You may have had such feelings, but you'd have had difficulty putting them into words. Kipling's genius, I suppose, in many ways, was that he actually was able to put these feelings into words. I can't say that we ever strongly felt that or seriously felt it, although nevertheless what Kipling says in this respect is probably true. You know, it's Tommy this and it's Tommy that, and you know, probably quite true. But personally speaking, and for the people, you know, for the probably most of the people around me, we didn't have any very strong feelings about it.
Now, can we come on to Korea, and can you tell me what recollections you have, if any, of the Korean War breaking out and what your own reaction was?
Yes, well, just to go back a little bit, leading up to that, as I said before, I had spent 2 years, or about 2 years, in the Mediterranean Fleet. I was on board HMS Liverpool, cruiser, and we toured around the Mediterranean and visited various countries and so on. And I think a certain amount of that rubbed off on me, experience of... It was the first time, let's face it, that I'd ever met other people, other nationalities, and seen foreign countries and things like that. But I was sent back from the Liverpool, myself and another colleague, to do an advanced signal course at Portsmouth. And we finished that successfully. And then I was on draft to go to, I think it was 42 or 45 commando at that time, were in Kuala Lumpur, in Malaya. And I was posted to, it was either 42 or 45, I forget. I was posted there. I had my embarkation leave, and I was just waiting to go to Malaya. This would be... what, I suppose, May, June 1950, and it was then that the Korean War broke out. I think it was June 1950. I can't remember exactly when, probably a few weeks after that, there was a notice went up on the company notice board asking for volunteers for a special commando unit which was being formed for service somewhere in the Far East. It didn't specifically say Korea, but we all knew it was Korea. Everyone knew. They wanted volunteers. I seriously considered volunteering. But I had a friend in the commando in Kuala Lumpur. He was also signals like me. I was in communications. And obviously, because I'd spent a couple of years at radio college training, I was fairly proficient in signals. I mean, I just didn't have to learn very much when I did the training courses. And he had written to me saying that they had... there was quite a large radio station in KL, in Kuala Lumpur, and he said that, you know, when I got out there, he was going to see if he could get me in there, which I rather fancied. It was rather a good... a square number, as we used to say. So I didn't volunteer, actually, for the commander unit to perform services in the Far East. They had quite a lot of volunteers. A few days after that, another notice went up to the effect that although most of the volunteers that acquired had, you know, they had managed to get them, there was, however, a lack of specialized personnel, you know, like signals engineers, people like that. And therefore, the undermentioned ranks had been posted to the unit. And my name was there. I had been put in the unit. But in all fairness, it was said in the last sentence of the notice that all the men who had been posted and who had not volunteered were to be interviewed the following morning by, I think it was the major at that time, the major of the new 41 commander. And we were interviewed the following day. And there was quite a number of people who, for domestic or family reasons, who had small children and so on, didn't particularly want to join this unit. And as far as I know, anyone who objected was taken off the list. So as far as I recall. When it came my turn to be interviewed, as I say, already initially I had thought about volunteering for the unit, you know. And then when I saw my name was up there, I thought, well, that's all right, doesn't matter. Probably by the time we get to Korea anyway, the war will be over because the Americans were in, and, you know, I mean, what the heck could the North Koreans do against the American armed forces? You know, we figured the war would probably be over by the time we got there. So, anyway, during the interview with the major, it was more or less... he asked us, you know, if we had any objections. Well, I told him I didn't have any particular objections. That was quite all right. After all, that's what I'd been trained for and so on. And at the end of it, he said, well, you know, Conrad, are you with us? And yes, sir. You see, about turn, quick march. And that was it. As I say, I didn't really mind. And then I tended to rationalize. And I thought, well, we'll at least be able to see Japan anyway and, you know, do a bit more travel and... probably by the time we get there or fairly soon afterwards, the war will be over, and then I'll go to Malaya anyway. I'll just be sent down to Malaya, so nothing's lost.
Did you go to Korea with the attitude that it was just another job, or was there any kind of crusading element in it as far as you were concerned?
A little bit of both, I suppose. I suppose, you see, politically at that time, I wasn't really a political animal. I was basically from a working class family and from a working class area. Most of my family were labor supporters, and I suppose on the whole, mainly because their fathers and grandfathers had voted labor anyway, so, you know, I dare say it was a them and us situation. I had never grown up with any very strong, never any political convictions at all. I just, I suppose to put it in a very simplistic way, politicians to me at that time were just people who were doing a job, like lawyers or doctors or dentists and so on do their jobs, and a politician was more or less the same thing. That's the way I saw it. I suppose on the whole I was anti-communist at the time, and had the feeling that that the communists were out to take over the world, But in a very simple way, it was something I never really read much about or took a great interest in. It was just, I suppose, a fairly general feeling at that time among people of my age group. You tended to see that the Russians were taking over the world. You know, they had come through the Second World War, and although we knew, certainly were aware of the great losses the Russians had suffered in the war, and that they had borne the brunt of the German attack. Nevertheless, I saw them as being very wily characters who, at the end of the war, had managed to swallow up, Poland and Czechoslovakia. Excuse me. In other words, extend their boundaries. So I had this feeling that the communists were out to take over the world. And then, of course, it was the Chinese communists or North Koreans or whoever they might be, and I just saw it as a very straight case of aggression against South Korea. And we were being sent there to help, because it was, at that time, not a war, remember, it was a police action. And we were sort of United Nations police, if you like, and we were going in to do or to help perform a police function. In its simplest way, that was, I suppose, my feeling. Another factor in it was that my brother was in the RAF in the Second World War. He had been taken prisoner at Singapore. He was wounded and captured by the Japanese, and he later worked on the Siam Railway. And he was a prisoner, I think, for about 3 years or just over. He survived, I remember chatting to him when he came home and, about his prisoner of war experiences. It was something he didn't like to relate. He didn't like to talk about it too much, but I was, of course, several years younger than him. And I remember occasionally he and I would just sit and chat, and I would ask about some of his experiences, you know. And he told me that things, under the Japanese in the camps were very, very rough. It was pretty tough. And he said they were maltreated, they were beaten out. But then, strangely enough, he also told me, he said that, well, to some extent it was bad, but although the Japanese soldiers beat them up, they also beat up their own soldiers in much the same way. And he had a kind of, I suppose he had a more objective view of it than many other accounts that I read. The Japanese were just put down by a lot of people as being total animals and so on. But this wasn't quite his viewpoint. He didn't like them. He hated them. But at the same time, he did have this viewpoint that although they treated them harshly, they also treated their own people harshly. But I remember him telling me that the Japanese were pretty rough on them sometimes, but worst were the Koreans, because there were a lot of Koreans in the Japanese army, as you probably know. And he had the opinion, rightly or wrongly, that there were occasions where the Koreans would beat them up in a more savage and sadistic way than the Japanese. So another part of my thinking when I was on the way to Korea was that, well, I didn't really like these Koreans very much. I didn't have much love for the Japanese, and they were just Japs, they were just Orientals, but I had a dislike for the Koreans because of the way they had treated my brother. So I suppose these feelings, these personal feelings, were probably uppermost in my mind to the exclusion of, say, a serious political thought or analysis of the situation in Korea.
How did you actually get there?
We went from the commando school. This was rather amusing in actual fact, because we flew out. We flew to Japan, and we had apparently, or we had to fly over certain countries where troops or soldiers weren't supposed to fly over. I think at the time Egypt was one. So consequently, we all had to wear civilian clothes. And everything was supposed to be hush-hush and secret and so on. And I remember leaving the commando school and coming up to London. I forget, but we came into a station in London. And we came into the station in London in our civilian clothes, but we're all carrying our kit bags. Is it all right? We're all carrying our kit bags, of course, you know, with our division and our name and 41 Commando. And there was quite a few press people, I think, that took some photographs. I remember the time there was some cartoons printed, you know, a big burly Marine with civilian clothing on, carrying his kit bag, you know, Royal Marines Commando on it. Anyway, we travelled out, as far as I remember, in two groups, each of about 50 or 60. It's quite a small unit. Or it might even be less, it might have been 30 or 40. And I travelled out on the first group, and we flew from London. Passed through Cairo. Remember, before we got off the plane at Cairo, we were instructed or told, if anyone asks you any questions, we're a football team. We were a football team travelling somewhere. And I think we stopped at Rome, Cairo, Basra. I remember stopping at Basra, Rangoon, Hong Kong, Okinawa, and finally we got to Japan. We went to an American Army camp, Camp McGill, which at that time I think was just it was Yokosuka, I think it was. And eventually the second lot of our commando came, and we set up. We of course didn't take any weapons with us. We had our uniforms. We were issued with summer uniforms in Hong Kong, I remember, jungle greens. We were kitted up with American weapons. We were trained in the use of American weapons because most of us hadn't seen American weapons. We wore M1s and Thompsons. And we trained there for a bit. We trained in rubber boats off both off submarines and off what they call a troop carrying destroyer. They were American. And after a few weeks, then we started doing raids actually on the in North Korea behind the lines.
Based in Japan.
Based in Japan, yeah. We went from Japan down to Sasebo, where we boarded the destroyer or submarine. We were operating in two groups. And the drill was that I was on the destroyer, the USS Bass, and she would lie off the coast maybe about 5 miles, 3 to 5 miles. We would then get into our rubber boats, invariably sort of in the very early hours of the morning, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And there was a little, they had a little motorboat. We would then hook our rubber boats onto the motorboat, and she would tow us into, depending on the surf conditions, to maybe 1 mile or 2 miles even off the coast. We would then unhook from the power boat, and we would row in.
How many of you?
I can't remember exactly, but it must have been something in the order of about 20 or a group of about 20 or perhaps 30. Three or four boats, each containing, I think, 6 or 8 men.
Armed with automatic weapons, grenades?
Yeah, mainly light weapons. Light weapons, machine gun, I think, was the heaviest. Brens, or it wasn't a Bren, it was a BAR. Browning automatic rifle, which was the American equivalent of the Bren. That was about the heaviest weapon we had. It was, as I say, mostly light weapons, M1s, carbines, 45s, Thompsons, grease guns, what they call a grease gun, which is like a fires a 45 slug. We would then row in and beach the boats, and then we'd go in and mainly we blew up tunnels, railway bridges. They were mostly targets that were either impossible or very difficult to hit from the air because of their geographical location, but they were important targets. And it was quite well planned. The operations were quite, you know, carefully planned, and we were very well briefed before we went in on maps and with various contingency plans if this went wrong, what to do if you were left behind, or, you know, you wait, and what signals to give and things like that. Pretty well planned operation, planned basically by Marines, by Marine officers, in conjunction with the American Navy, of course, obviously.
How much opposition would you meet?
Fortunately, we never met any real opposition.
Didn't they have guards on these tunnels?
The few places that we hit didn't have any. There was one occasion when we went in. You see, usually we'd send one man in before to find out what the defences were on the beach. As I say, in most cases there was never anything, because I don't suppose they expected people to come in there. There was also the danger of the beach being mined. We usually sent one man in ahead. He swam in.
Was that ever you?
Sorry?
Was that ever you?
It wasn't me, no. I never ever did it. It was usually an officer, in actual fact. And he swam in and reconnoitred the beach, you know, and then if everything was clear, he signalled to us, and then we came in. There was one occasion when we went in. It was a tunnel, I think we blew up a tunnel. And we set the charges, and we then had to go back to the beach and alter the boats and away. But there was some delay in getting back to the beach. There was a little bit of a kerfuffle. But anyway, that sorted itself out. But we were delayed in getting back to the beach. But we were just leaving the beach, maybe 50 or 100 yards out, when the explosive charges went off and the whole place went up in a great roar, and there were lumps of earth and dirt and everything came down on top of us. And there was a large hill just to one side of the beach. I think there must have been an army post or something up there, because they opened up on us with machine guns. But by this time, the drill for coming out, you see, is the boat would then close in to the shore to maybe half a mile. The motorboat would then sit maybe a couple of hundred yards, 200 or 300 yards out. We'd then just have to row to the motorboat, hook on to the cable they had, and then away we'd go. She'd pull us out. You hung on then for grim death, and the boats just used to go over the noses well up. So as I say, the destroyer had closed in, and they then opened up with their heavy guns on this mountain, and because all this stuff was coming over our heads. But fortunately, I remember some of us saying, "Thank God, you know, they're on our side," and they must have lowered this hilltop by a few inches, and anyway, all the firing then stopped, and we got back.
So did you suffer any casualties on these raids?
Suffered one or two occasionally. There were a couple of accidental deaths, you know, where people didn't get